This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On April 11th, 20-year-old Dante Wright was fatally shot by police in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, during a traffic stop. In the following days, hundreds of protesters took to the streets. Noor Adwan joined the protests on April 15th.
That evening was remarkably peaceful. Most of the crowds dispersed before the curfew was in place. No real police involvement at all, besides just sitting behind the fence.
Adwan is a sophomore at the University of Minnesota and a self-described activist.
So honestly, when I went in again on the 16th, that's what I was expecting. You know, there was chanting, there was shouting, there was a barbecue, there was there were people selling t-shirts, there was music, you know. There's this real, like, sense of community that you experience.
Things changed later that evening. According to state officials, around 9 o'clock, a group of protesters began to throw glass bottles, rocks, and other objects at police. The Minnesota Department of Public Safety says 30 minutes later, protesters attempted to breach fences surrounding the Brooklyn Center Police Department. Adwan says she wasn't aware of what was going on. She says with the music and chanting, she did not hear police's call for protesters to disperse just before 10 p.m. Here's what that dispersal order sounded like, according to video taken by local news station Care 11.
Very rapidly, it became chaotic. The police did use flashbangs and then, you know, eventually tear gas and mace. And then after that, we responded by opening umbrellas and creating that kind of umbrella barricade that you might see in some photos and videos from that night. I and, you know, 99% of the other people who were there were, you know, at this moment, right before the arrest took place. Yeah, many of us were kneeling behind umbrellas, really nothing that could be construed as offensive.
According to Minnesota Public Radio, law enforcement drastically changed their tactics that night. Previously, they'd chosen not to enforce the curfew, and they let protesters disperse on their own. But on the night of the 16th, police arrested 136 people, including Adwan.
It seems like an abuse of power, to be quite honest, when you're holding all of these people that you arrest, you know, just in mass, and then you release 90% of them. It just doesn't make any sense.
Adwan was eventually released without being charged. She maintains her involvement in the protest was entirely peaceful. But around the country, lawmakers have proposed new measures that could significantly expand the definition of a riot and vastly increase the number of arrests like Adwan's and lead to charges. So today we're going to take a look at the bills, their intent, and their impact on lawful dissent in a democracy. And we'll start with Ellie Page, senior legal advisor at the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law, who's been tracking these anti-protest bills. Ellie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, give us a sense as to how many proposals we're talking about and where across the United States.
So this is very much a national trend. We've tracked over 90 bills introduced in 35 states since last summer and the murder of George Floyd that would restrict the right to peacefully assemble and protest. This is a distinct escalation from prior years in our tracking experience.
Distinct as in how distinct?
So we've been monitoring through our U.S. protest law tracker, we've been monitoring anti-protest bills for over 4.5 years now. And it's what we've seen in the past 10 months is unprecedented, both in terms of the number of bills introduced, the extent to which they're moving through the legislatures and passing, and the extreme lengths they go to restrict and chill protest rights.
Okay, so describe then some of those lengths. What is new and unprecedented in some of these bills?
Sure. So these bills, first of all, create extreme new criminal penalties for things that may happen during a completely peaceful protest. So you see many of these bills introducing felony penalties, for instance, for a street protest that interferes with traffic. The bills create sweeping, kind of vaguely defined new criminal offenses that can be enforced in a targeted manner and that can cover peaceful protesters. And the bills, many of them, actually enable violence against protesters by creating new protections for people who injure and even kill protesters, including for drivers who hit protesters with their cars.
Well, Ellie Page, if you'll just stand by for a moment, let's turn now to what's happening in Florida, where they have a combating public disorder bill that is pending. And joining us now from Tallahassee is Representative Juan Fernandez-Barquin, Republican representative for Florida's 119th House District. Congressman Fernandez-Barquin, welcome to On Point.
Hey, how are you, Magna? Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad to have you. So tell me, this bill that's pending in the Florida state legislature, what is it designed to accomplish?
Well, first, actually, the governor signed it April 19th.
And
it took effect immediately upon his signing. But basically, Magna, the way I look at it is that this bill protects peaceful protesters' First Amendment rights, and I'll get into that later. It protects the residents of the state of Florida, and most important of all, it protects our law enforcement. And I think the whole context, and when I get into the details of the bill, the underlying theme here is that the number one duty of government is really to protect its residents, and that's what this bill does.
First of all, I just want to say thank you for the correction there on the fact that it has been signed into law. I appreciate that. So that makes this actually all the more pressing because Floridians now are living under this new law as of April 19th, as you said. So, first of all, the bill, as far as I understand, it first of all expands the definition of a riot, including saying that a person commits a riot if he or she willfully participates, quote, in a violent public disturbance involving an assembly of three or more persons acting with a common intent to assist each other in violent and disorderly conduct that can result in several things. So tell me a little bit more about that definition. Why did Florida need to put in place that definition? What need does it serve that existing Florida law didn't already have?
The previous Florida law, the definition of riot was previously defined by the courts in a 1975 state Supreme Court case, and I could read that definition for you. It's from a case named State v. Beasley, and in that specific case, the court defined riot, and in my opinion, we narrowly tailored it to clarify that it has to be violent public disturbance. And the old definition is the following: the term riot, at common law, is defined as a tumultuous disturbance of the peace by three or more persons assembled and acting with a common intent, either in executing a lawful private enterprise in a violent and turbulent manner to the terror of the people, or in executing an unlawful enterprise in a violent and turbulent manner. So my position when the judiciary staff and I were working on this and clarifying how to narrowly tailor the definition of riot, I looked specifically to do away with these old vague terms of tumultuous disturbance, terror of the people, breach of the peace, to clarify that it has to be someone who's willfully participating in this, and there has to be some sort of violent component to it, because I think the worst thing, the biggest injustice that could be done in a peaceful demonstration is to arrest peaceful protesters. And by clarifying that it has to be some sort of violent participation, I think that we sufficiently protect the peaceful protesters and clarify that it's these violent individuals that the police have the ability to go after.
Okay, so Congressman, stand by here for just a second. Let me just quickly turn back to Ellie Page, because to Ellie, to give listeners some of the definitions that the congressman's talking about that are in the Florida law now, it's A, injury to another person, B, damage to property, C, imminent danger of injury to another person, or damage to property. So you heard the congressman, Ellie, say that that's actually a narrowing rather than an expansion of the definition of a riot or violent behavior. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting take. I think there are still significant issues with this definition, and I think both you and the congressman hit on it. When you're talking about there being willful participation by an individual in a group where there is a quote-unquote violent component, as the congressman said, that definition does not require actual violence by an individual who is then effectively liable to arrest and charges for riot. There is no requirement in this definition that an individual be personally responsible for any violence, for any property damage. In fact, the group itself doesn't need to commit any actual injury or any actual damage. As you see in that definition, there only needs to be a quote-unquote danger of injury or property damage. Mm. So I think that leaves a lot of vagueness and a lot of opportunity for peaceful protesters to be caught up in riot arrests and charges.
So Congressman Fernandez-Barquin, we've just got about 30 seconds before we have to take a first break here, but let me get you to respond to that quickly. I mean, it is true. It just says imminent danger. Who gets to interpret that?
Well, I think imminent danger, you'd have to take a look at the Florida assault statute, which also refers to imminent danger, and the jury instruction on that is essentially that it's really about to take place. I mean, close proximity, about to take place. I mean, this is not an individual standing 15 feet away from somebody else. This is an individual, and historically the case law on that in Florida has been that it's an individual who is really close proximity, right, about to commit danger.
Well, Congressman, just didn't mean to interrupt you there. We just have to take a really quick 1 minute break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In this hour, we're exploring the raft of anti-protest legislation that is in more than 30 states across the country right now, in several states in which those pieces of legislation have passed into law. And I'm joined today by Ellie Page. She's senior legal advisor at the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law. And Congressman Juan Fernandez-Barquin joins us as well. He's Republican representative for Florida's 119th House District, and he joins us from Tallahassee today. And Congressman, I know I've just got you for a couple of more minutes here, so let me try to make the most of that time. I'd like to get a better understanding in terms of possible ways in which the new Florida law might come into play in lives of Floridians. So let me present you with a hypothetical. It's a hypothetical based on things that have happened in Florida. So, for example, say there is a protest and a counter-protest over gun control, and you've got, you know, several dozen people on either side of this protest. Oftentimes, folks can get pretty close to each other. They can get in each other's faces. Looking here at the law, it says that, you know, that a riot can be declared if there's an imminent danger of injury to another person. Aggravated rioting, which is a new charge, can be a charge if someone in a group of 25 or more also displays uses or threatens to use a deadly weapon, even just displaying that deadly weapon. So say folks brought their, you know, brought their guns to this protest. Would just standing there arguing with someone they disagree with, having their guns with them, would that person have committed aggravated rioting in Florida now?
That's a great question, Magna. So the whole purpose with aggravated rioting is that the aggravated rioting, the base charge of aggravated rioting is that the person has to be committing a riot. So there has to be some sort of violent component of injury to another person, damage to property, or imminent danger of injury to another person or damage to property in order for there to be that the aggravated rioting. And then it's one of those specific elements that make it the aggravated rioting. Now, the example that you gave, for instance, I would say, one, that individual is going to have some serious issues because Florida's a concealed weapons state, mm-hmm. and it's not open carry here. So, I mean, first, that individual is definitely going to get arrested just for having that out in the open. That is definitely not tolerated here. And two, if there is some sort of violent and disorderly conduct going on in between those groups, it certainly is possible that that individual, that specific individual, will possibly be arrested for aggravated rioting. But I think his bigger issue is definitely going to be displaying the firearm, because that's just not allowed. But it certainly is possible. It just depends what's going on between those two factions and the amount of violence that's going on between those two. That would really be the determinant factor.
Well, so in the last minute I have you, Congressman, let me ask this, because I think it repeatedly is coming down to someone is going to be in charge of interpreting what is considered imminent danger. Someone's going to be in charge of interpreting what's considered to be possible violence. And that person is usually a law enforcement officer. Now, even before someone has done anything, we're relying on law enforcement to interpret. I mean, that's like a pre-crime world. How is that constitutional?
Well, I mean, Magna, all our laws, all our criminal laws are initially interpreted by law enforcement. Then there's a second evaluation of those laws by the prosecutor in those specific cases. In Florida, in Miami-Dade, for instance, as far as the initial charge of riot, off the top of my head, I'm pretty sure that in Miami-Dade, they arrested roughly about 60 to 70 individuals after the George Floyd protests. They arrested them for rioting in downtown Miami because there was a lot of damage done. 4 police cars were burned. But I mean, in that specific case, those individuals were arrested. But if memory serves me correctly, the prosecutor did not file charges against any of them. And in Broward, I want to say about 30 individuals were arrested and maybe one or two were charged because there was video evidence. The bottom line is that it's just like any other crime. Law enforcement makes the initial decision. And then the prosecutor will make the decision on whether or not to proceed with the charges.
Well, Congressman Juan Fernandez-Barquin, Republican representative for Florida's 119th House District, with us from Tallahassee today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Magna. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Ellie Page, let me turn back to you. You heard the congressman's point there about all existent law that is enforced on the streets of the United States is subject to the interpretation of law enforcement officers. So therefore, not much of a difference according to him, with these new proposals or laws. Your response?
Yeah, well, first, I mean, I'm glad the congressman brought up existing law, because I think it's important to remember that this new law and sort of across the country, these proposed laws are unnecessary. I mean, in almost all cases, police and prosecutors have more than enough tools at their disposal to punish the kind of conduct that lawmakers are claiming to target with these bills. In most, if not all cases, the bills are aimed at the kind of conduct that's already a criminal offense, such as blocking a street or vandalizing monuments and other public property. But these bills would change the law to make the penalty for that conduct extreme and chilling, not just not just punitive, and again, create these kind of sweeping new offenses that can cover much more than that illegal conduct.
Mm. I would love to get some more examples on the table here, because I think, I mean, with everything, but especially when we have this sort of almost seemingly overnight eruption of new legislation, the specificity, the details really matter here. So we've talked about Florida for a little bit here. Could you give us some other examples? Like, first of all, an Oklahoma law, a new Oklahoma law increases penalties, for example, for demonstrators who block public roadways. Can you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. This is something we've seen in a number of bills, particularly this session. I think it's 50 bills out of those more than 90 since last May that would increase the penalty for blocking traffic. And again, that's almost always already a legal violation of some kind, but it's usually sort of a low-level misdemeanor. So the Oklahoma law would increase that penalty dramatically. The Oklahoma law is an example of this trend that is perhaps the most horrific trend in many of these bills, which is the ways in which they enable violence against protesters. So this Oklahoma law essentially creates new protections for a driver who unintentionally injures or even kills a protester who's in the street. If the driver is, quote unquote, fleeing a riot, it would allow that driver to avoid any criminal or civil consequences. So we've seen at least 15 bills since last summer's protests that use that tactic, essentially meaning that someone who recklessly drives over a protester can avoid any charges or civil lawsuits. I think there were over 100 people who were hit by cars while protesting last summer, and it's hard to imagine how these kinds of legal provisions won't continue, if not exacerbate, that awful trend.
This seems remarkable to me because it wasn't that long ago where, you know, we would look at events that had happened in other countries, for example, where someone drove a vehicle into a crowd, and we called that terrorism. And I suppose supporters of these bills would say the distinction is the unintentional part, right? That's in these laws. Do you see that as a critical distinction, Ellie?
I mean, I think it's helpful to have that kind of limiting language, but even still, having laws like this on the books, it's again hard to see how people won't take that as kind of implicit permission to drive more recklessly when they're approaching protesters in the street.
In Kentucky, I understand there's a law now that makes it illegal to taunt officers, but it doesn't define taunting. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, and this is another thing we've seen this year, both in the Kentucky bill, which thankfully has now expired, but also in Ohio, where there's a pending bill in the House that would prohibit, again, taunting a police officer and being reckless about whether or not it distracted that officer. And again, taunt is not defined by the bill. So essentially, I mean, especially when you think about the context of protests against police killings, this kind of prohibition could clearly cover protected speech by protesters, chanting by protesters that even that law enforcement claims distracts them.
So just to be clear, it's leaving the interpretation or definition of taunting to law enforcement officers themselves.
That's correct, at least in the first instance, as far as making arrests.
I've got to ask, how is that constitutional?
I think that is very much an open question. I mean, our ICNL is not involved in litigation, so I would defer to folks who are bringing constitutional challenges against these new laws. But I think there are clear arguments to be made that these kinds of initiatives are obviously discouraging people from speaking out and chilling their exercise of First Amendment rights.
Okay, so let me ask you here. What do you think is really going on? Because I keep wondering about a question that – or something you pointed out earlier, that there is quite a bit of extant law that controls people's right – constitutional right to protest already in the United States. Look, we are decades past the time where, during major political events, for example, I remember – years ago, 16 or so years ago, the Democratic National Convention here in Boston, where I am, protesters were essentially kettled into pens far away from the convention itself. We have been in this world for a long time. So what is distinctly different this time around? What's really going on here?
Well, I think in many ways, I mean, it's the continuation of a trend that at least we've seen while tracking these sort of legislative initiatives, which is that lawmakers, instead of engaging with the concerns that have motivated people to turn out and speak out, instead of doing that they seek to silence protest movements. So we've seen time and time again lawmakers introduce these anti-protest initiatives in the aftermath of distinct protest movements. This is the case, for instance, since the Keystone Pipeline protests at Standing Rock. We've seen dozens of bills target and punish protesters near gas and oil pipelines. So likewise, I think with this wave of legislation, lawmakers have made very clear that they're responding not to protest concerns about systemic racism and police violence, but responding to the protests themselves and seeking to quash them.
Ellie, hang on here for a second, because I'd like now to introduce Susan Stokes into the conversation. She's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago and director of the Chicago Center on Democracy. Professor Stokes, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Meghna. Great to be here.
So first of all, give us your big take here. How are this new sort of crop of bills and now in many places laws, are they distinctly different from limits to protests that we've seen before?
Well, I think Ellie Page just put her finger on it. I think that the main purpose of this wave of legislation or intended legislation is to, first of all, discourage people from getting involved in protests, to sort of have a chilling effect. And secondly, there's a little bit of political theater going on, sort of, state-level legislators. And in the case of Florida, I think it has to do as well with kind of presidential ambitions of the governor, kind of saying, here I am, we're the real law and order people, we're going to be very tough with protesters, especially protesters who are trying to stop violence against African-American and other people of color, protest against police abuse and killings of those members of our community. So I think that's what's going on, much more so than sort of serious legal efforts to fine-tune the laws and make them more fair or more precise.
Mm. Well, folks, we want to know what you think. So hop on social media, Twitter or Facebook. As always, you can find us at On Point Radio and give us your thoughts on these bills and laws and the state of a person's right to protest in the United States and how we strike a balance, if that's the right way of putting it, between protecting the right to dissent in a democracy. And as you heard the congressman from Florida say earlier, he believes it's also these new laws are needed to protect people as well. So are those two things in opposition? Do these laws help strike that balance or not? We're at On Point Radio. So, Professor Stokes, you did actually hear the congressman a little bit earlier. I'd love to get your take on what he said, because he was very clear at the beginning of his time with us, where he said this is about protecting Floridians, and he also said protecting law enforcement. What's your response to that?
Well, I think that these kinds of laws are part and parcel with the moves of kind of populist authoritarian parties and leaders around the world who don't like their citizens to be able to protest, don't like seeing opposition protesters in the streets, just as they don't necessarily like, opposition supporting voters to go to the polls. And so it's quite familiar. I mean, I remember several years ago, there were major protests in Turkey against actions by the Erdogan government and really against the heavy-handed treatment of protesters by the police. And the Erdogan government said, you know, it's fine. We're fine with protests. We're going to make a space available for protests. So instead of being in the middle of Istanbul, we've got a nice little sort of plot of land way out in the middle of nowhere that you should feel free to go protest. So it's of the essence of protest that they will be somewhat inconvenient, noisy, attention grabbing. That's what they do. That's how they work. And there are, you know, all kinds of laws that, ban, violent actions by protesters. I don't really buy the congressman saying that, we don't have sufficient laws on the books in Florida or elsewhere to prosecute people who engage in violence during protests.
So Professor Stokes and Ellie Page, just got to take our second quick break here. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Later this week, we're going to return to one of my obsessions, which is infrastructure, and we're going to focus on broadband access across this country, but particularly in rural America. More than 100 million Americans do not have access to broadband internet, according to some estimates, and we want to know if that's you. Have you had to live, especially in this pandemic year that upended everything, without broadband, or have you recently got connected, and what difference did it make to you, for your family, for your business maybe, for your children and school? We'd love to hear your stories of rural broadband or lack thereof. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for a show about rural broadband, which we're going to be bringing to you later this week. Today, we are talking about the almost 100 proposals and in some states now laws that are redefining or expanding, I should say, the definition of riots. They're called a new suite of anti-protest bills. And we're trying to explore what's causing them, what's given rise to these bills, and what impact it might have on your right to dissent in a democracy. I'm joined today by Ellie Page. She's senior legal advisor at the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law. They've been tracking these laws. And Susan Stokes joins us. She's professor of political science at the University of Chicago and director of the Chicago Center on Democracy. And Ellie Page, we've got a question that's come in online, which I should have asked earlier. Anyway, Gerald Winand wants to know how many of these bills are from conservative bill mills, as Gerald put it, like Alec.
So ICNL is not we're a nonpartisan organization, but just as a factual matter, we know that these bills are have been introduced overwhelmingly by Republican lawmakers. We have not seen any clear evidence of involvement of Alec. On the other hand, there's been very clear evidence that there's a lot of copying and pasting going on in this legislation. Comparing state to state and bill to bill, you see a lot of similar provisions, sometimes identical provisions.
Well, and just so for folks who don't know what ALEC is, let me be specific about that. ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council. They call themselves a forum to exchange ideas and develop state-based solutions to encourage growth, preserve economic security and protect individual rights and markets at the state level. They are well known for having authored lots of language for bills that have been largely introduced on many subjects by conservative lawmakers at the state level over many years. Now, Professor Stokes, let me turn back to you here. The overwhelming fact is that most protests in the United States are peaceful. I don't know what the exact number is, but it's only a small portion of them that do measurably turn violent. But is part of the problem here that depending on what information bubble you are in, what media bubble you are in, you might have very different opinions about what sort of an average protest in America looks like. And so therefore, there are many millions of Americans who, if you ask them, they would honestly tell you, well, what I see on TV is most protests are violent and we have to do something about it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that you have a kind of narrative around protests, such as the protests that we saw last summer, where, they are almost by definition defined as violent. And some of them have been. I mean, I live in Chicago. We definitely had looting and destruction of property in our downtown during the protests. There was a lot of anger, a lot of frustration, and some just plain old opportunistic folks coming in and engaging in violence. The organizers of protests know that they win points in public opinion when they control that violence, when their side is not engaged in violence. So they have a built-in reason to try to clamp down on violent actions. But as you say, what actually happens and then what gets reported and sort of spun in the media can be two quite different things. If you think about in the civil rights movement in the 60s, the violent crackdowns on peaceful protesters followers of Martin Luther King and others, that was broadcast into the homes of many millions of people through a newish medium at that point called television through the nightly news. And the violence on the side of police and sheriff's departments and so on, drove a bulk of public opinion in favor of the civil rights movement and legislation. Now we're in a somewhat different world where what you learn about what's going on in the streets of your own city or other cities is going to be a byproduct of what cable station you tune into. So that is a new kind of dynamic.
I hear what you're saying about what happened in Chicago. Portland comes up repeatedly as an example with peaceful protests, but along with violence and damage to property and businesses as well. But I think the overall point here is, or the overall area that I want to explore with both of you is really, what is this saying about the state of our democracy? Because prior to to these laws, my impression was, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression was that there was a clearer line, like the violence actually had to have occurred. But what I'm seeing in these bills is, again, that interpretation, that vagueness, that quote-unquote threat of. So people don't really actually have to have committed a violent act for them to be arrested and then subsequently potentially charged by law enforcement. That's putting an awful lot more responsibility into the hands of law enforcement. I mean, is it not, Professor Stokes?
I think it is. And I think that what you are pointing to is, or the question you're asking is, what does this say about the state of our democracy? Well, we're seeing similar kinds of efforts with regard to voting to sort of clamp down on citizen participation. So, instead of a system in which we have, two major parties that vie for support among the public, one of the parties in particular is basically decided to clamp down on participation, be it at the voting booth or in protests, and try to win points with their own side. It's obviously a byproduct of a very, very polarized situation. I don't think it's a good strategy for the Republican Party, actually, in the longer term. I think this particular set of laws is likely to encourage protests. There, as frequently as not, harsh police responses to protests just encourages them, makes them bigger. We have big backlash movements. Mm-hmm. And, you know, suburban women who turned against the Republican Party in large numbers in our last sets of elections don't like a society in which there's violence, disturbances, you know, police arrests, you know, violent outbursts of various kinds. I don't think it's a good strategy for the party as a whole, but I think that's what we're seeing.
Are we seeing creeping authoritarianism? Is that what this is?
I'm afraid we are. And I'm afraid that this is, again, a continuation. You know, the most worrisome, this all is very worrisome. The most worrisome thing going on in our society is we have a political party that's not accepting a loss of an election. And that's very dangerous. So putting the idea out that has taken hold in a big chunk of our fellow citizens that that the last election was stolen, you know, that's a very dangerous path to be going down. And that's, you know, part of the motivation and the justification for ballot access restriction laws that we also are seeing in many of these same states as these anti-protest laws. And it is a drift toward authoritarianism, and it's a very frightening development. And you know, all small D Democrats in our society should be very, very concerned about these trends.
Well, let's listen to a moment to Brittany Packnett Cunningham, a Black Lives Matter activist. She was on MSNBC Thursday talking about these anti-protest bills, and here's what she said.
This is what you do when you cannot win fair and square. You suppress votes and you suppress voice. So we have to pay attention here because the GOP plays the long game and they play the expansive game. They plan far in advance. They gerrymander states so that they can control state houses. And then they use all of that power to maintain their power and suppress us from multiple angles. So then they make it illegal to engage in the two most democratic practices you've got in this country. And they make sure to target Black folks when they do it.
Ellie Page, you want to respond to that?
I mean, I think that sounds pretty right on. I mean, as I've said, lawmakers, instead of responding to protesters' concerns, are seeking to stifle people's voices. And I think just going to sort of this question of disparate impact and whether or not this is entirely new. I mean, you were asking about sort of the implications of vague new definitions, mm-hmm. and the power that gives police and prosecutors. It absolutely, that kind of discretion absolutely enables disparate treatment. It allows police to respond to one community's protest differently than another's. And we know that charges, historically, charges like riot and unlawful assembly are disproportionately levied against communities of color. We know from the sort of legislative impact analyses of some of these bills that that riot crimes, for instance, in Iowa last year, African-Americans made up more than 70% of those convicted of riot crimes, despite making up only 4% of the population. Mm. And of course, we've seen that kind of disparate treatment on full display when you think about how armed protesters at various state capitals who were protesting COVID restrictions were treated last year as compared to racial justice protesters.
Yeah.
So I think these concerns are absolutely valid.
Well, On Point senior editor Dori Scheimer is here because she's been keeping track of response to this hour over social media. And Dori, what are some folks saying?
Yeah, Suzanne just left us a message from Iowa. She says these laws are incredibly dangerous because it means that nobody is safe to protest. What does it mean about our First Amendment if nobody is safe to protest without retribution? And the retribution is in the hands of partisan judges. I'm very frightened about our rights.
Okay. So Professor Stokes, let me just ask briefly about that because of the listeners' concern about partisan judges. The arrest is just the first step in the process. I mean, because I think we haven't talked enough about how because these are now newly defined crimes, people can be charged. I mean, that's where we started this hour, because the person that we featured at the beginning was not charged, but yet now people can be charged. I mean, your response to that.
Well, I think I agree with the person from Iowa. I think that there is, you can hear in the question that the fear and the, likely chilling effect of these kinds of laws on protest. On the other hand, I want to emphasize that when, in free societies, which ours still is, when people, protesters are treated harshly, 9 times out of 10, that makes protests get bigger, not smaller. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think this is the only thing I disagreed with the activist statement, which was beautifully put and very on mark. I don't agree that this is necessarily a good long game by the Republican Party. I think that these laws are going to contribute. One of the things we haven't talked much about is I think they are also designed to embolden police forces in acting harshly against protesters. But that, again, can backfire. Mm-hmm. And it can backfire in terms of protests, but it can also backfire in terms of elections. The GOP has lost a series of national elections and in recent years. And I think that the real long-term strategists in the party are not happy with being kind of in a corner where they find themselves at the state level pacifying and playing to very extreme primary voting kind of sets of the public and losing people in the middle in droves. Mm. Mm.
Greta left us a message on Facebook saying that she thinks that these laws are intended to silence people. One way this is done is by valuing property over the lives of protesters. Another way is by making the display of anger a crime. If insulting police is a crime or intent of harm, then the expression of anger can be judged by an officer or prosecutor as an intent to harm. This is a very clear tactic by those in power to keep their power.
That is interesting. Ellie Page, you want to respond to that sort of display of anger being made a crime?
Right. Well, that's certainly the concern with those bills around taunting the police and similar provisions we've seen elsewhere. And that kind of language combined with really harsh penalties, potential penalties, I think it really threatens to prevent people from, again, coming together and speaking out. It threatens to diminish constitutionally protected activity that's core to our engagement as citizens, and that's really fundamental to our democracy.
Yeah. Well, Professor Stokes, we've talked about the Constitution a little bit here, but my last question or two for you is some of these laws have already, they're going to be facing legal challenge. What's your take on the constitutionality here? I mean, we do have First Amendment rights to gather, to speech, et cetera. Do these cross the line?
Well, I think that Ellie Page's last comment is a great answer to that question. Some of these provisions, I think, will not pass muster constitutionally. If you can't shout your opinions to the police, if that's made illegal, I don't see how that doesn't violate the First Amendment. On the other hand, the kind of strengthening of punishment of things that are already illegal in an effort presumably to chill protest, those I think are going to be less fragile in terms of First mm-hmm. Amendment challenges, and that's potentially quite a severe shift for our society to take. Let me just say, there are some systems in which government
we have only a couple of seconds, Professor. Yeah. Like 10 seconds. I'm sorry.
Sorry. So China successfully clamps down on protests. It did so in Hong Kong last year. It did so in Tiananmen Square. That's the kind of level of repressive firepower that you need to bring to protests to really clamp down on them. We are not China. We have much more freedom and much more tolerance of protest in our DNA.
Well, Professor Susan Stokes and Ellie Page, thank you both so much for joining us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.